You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's agenda with Geoffrey Kaufman, ABC's London correspondent. What do you have for us today, Geoffrey?
Well, we have the story of that crack-smoking mayor in Toronto and three expense-rigging senators in Ottawa as squeaky clean Canada has mud in its eye.
More from Geoffrey a little later on in the program. Also, as prospects for peace between Israel and the Palestinians appear to crumble, we'll find out why the Jordan Valley could be key.
He's been hailed as the chronicler of the crisis facing a generation of young Europeans. But is Paul Van Haver just another rapper? Lauren Sellerous joins us from Brussels to profile the Belgian performer.
And we'll meet the director of the Academy of Urbanism, who is rethinking the way we use office space in an effort to support the growth of creative industries.
Most of the hubs we know about have grown organically. What started them was cheap and space with lots of capacity.
All that, plus we'll get the latest news from Serbia and play some music in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy Thursday edition of the program here on Monocle 24, but before all that, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
Representatives of major world powers are hoping for further progress today in renewed negotiations on Iran's nuclear program. 2 days of talks in Geneva will try to build on a meeting last month, which was described as substantive. The renewed optimism follows the election of Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani. But the Iranian commentator Mehrad Vahesi-Nejad said this latest round of talks could be much tougher.
It certainly is a continuation of that round, but it would definitely be more intense, more difficult, because they're getting down to what's real business. It's not just general terms, having a good atmosphere. They have to get down to the details sometimes, and that's where the problem lies.
Pakistan's former military ruler Pervez Musharraf has been released from house arrest, but he is still banned from leaving the country. The move comes days after he was bailed in the last legal case against him. Although Mr. Musharraf is now free to leave his home, it's not clear if he will, as there have been a number of threats to his life. Israel says a report suggesting the late Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat was poisoned is more soap opera than science. The Swiss report followed the decision to exhume his remains last year. 9 years after his death, it concludes there is evidence he was poisoned with the radioactive agent polonium. Arafat's widow, Suha, says it's stunned those close to him.
I felt shock and anger and huge sadness. And I was remembering his last days at hospital, how he was trying to fight. He has fought all his battles, and how difficult it was to fight his last battle.
The U.S. Secretary of State has told Israel's leaders he's sure peace with the Palestinians is within grasp. John Kerry is visiting the region to try to boost hopes of a negotiated settlement. He met the Israeli President Shimon Peres, who says it's vital to find a way forward.
All of us, Arabs, Jews, Palestinians, Israelis, we don't have a better alternative. It is so serious. And the cost of making peace goes up. And the price of not having it goes down. And we don't have so much time as people do think.
A powerful storm is heading for the Philippines. Typhoon Haiyan is due to reach land on Friday. Some schools have already been closed and evacuations have been ordered in regions most at risk from the storm. It's expected to hit areas still recovering from an earthquake last month. One of the world's biggest oil companies is rejecting claims that it's failed to report the true extent of oil spills in Nigeria. The human rights group Amnesty International says firms often blame sabotage to avoid paying compensation. But Shell says the allegation is unsubstantiated and insists the theft of crude oil remains the biggest cause of spills. Officials in Tajikistan have confirmed the country's president has been elected to another 7-year term in office. But there were questions over the conduct of the poll. The only candidate viewed as a genuine rival to Emomali Rahmon was barred from standing. Neither the EU or the US have recognized any election staged in Tajikistan as free or fair. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much to Paul Osborne. Well, it's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda. And joining us in the studio this morning is Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News, a transplanted Trontonium, though.
I'm hanging my head in shame. It's a good thing this is radio and not TV.
What is happening to our hometown, Jeffrey?
Oh, my gosh. My hometown, my home and native land. I know this has been on the agenda here more than once, but it's a story that just won't die. And for us journalists, it's one that really, how can you let it go? It's so astonishing. And Phil, we have to out you too. You're also a Canadian. Mm-hmm. So.
And I have to say, I'm feeling a little unsafe here with two Torontonians.
That's right. We want a crack pipe here.
Where's Tyler? He's from Toronto as well.
That's right. He's from Winnipeg, to be clear. But that's another story. We have two scandals in Canada, not just one. The one that's making world headlines and has people clucking, and the late night comedians in the U.S. going, "Woo! At least it's not here. Thank God it's somewhere else," is, of course, Rob Ford, the mayor of Toronto, who for months and months has indignantly said, "How dare you suggest I'm a crack-smoking mayor?" And then on Tuesday admitted that this video that he denied existed, that the chief of police last Thursday said, "Well, we actually found it, deleted on a hard drive." Suddenly, without telling his staff, this is a guy who, he's the anti-politician, and he just blurted out, "Okay, so I've smoked crack. I don't remember, I was so hammered, but I smoked crack." And I mean, it sounds funny, and it is, except this is in one of the largest cities in North America, the biggest city in Canada, and you've got a mayor who clearly has an alcohol problem. He's been seen publicly drunk a number of times recently, and denies that he has a problem. I think, you know, they say that the solution for Rob Ford isn't just resigning, it's 12 steps.
Well, did you see the Guardian's first pass at the headline, which was, "I smoke crack cocaine and I refuse to quit"? But I think that is at the heart of the matter, is that he won't just go.
He won't quit. And I've been reading up on the municipalities in many countries don't create their own existence. They're creatures of their larger counties, provinces, states, and that's exactly what Toronto is. And no one quite anticipated this kind of ethical issue. And so there isn't a law in that part of the world. You have to be convicted of a criminal offense in order to be removed from office. And shy of that, you can hang on. And this is a stubborn man who... there are all sorts of inconsistencies in what he says. I'm smiling because it's just so incredulous. He's saying, "You didn't ask me the right questions. You didn't ask me whether I actually have ever smoked crack," which isn't true. You know, the TV stations, the Toronto Star, and that broke this story along with Gawker, the U.S. Website. Have all pointed out that, in fact, he was directly asked, "Have you ever smoked crack cocaine?" I mean, this is a guy, he's like a 10-year-old in grade school trying to fib to his parents. And the odd thing about Rob Ford is that he does have a constituency.
Well, that's the thing.
He's still popular.
There are people that still really like him. You know, in Toronto, they're called Ford Nation, aren't they?
They are.
And there is quite a substantial population of Toronto that still back him.
I think it's a little bit of the Canadian reflection of the Tea Party. These are people who just want lower taxes, whatever the consequences. And they tend to be... Toronto went through a very, very badly managed amalgamation of its six regions into one mega city, I guess about 15 years ago now. It was very ill thought, and it created this tension between the downtown core and the suburbs. And it's really been a very ungovernable city with 44 city councillors, no political parties. And so you've got 44 plus the mayor. You don't have a strong mayor system, but you have. So it's really this terrific city that Peter Ustinov canonized memorably in the 70s as New York run by the Swiss is now New York run by a crack addict.
Let's move on to Ottawa.
Ottawa is another painful story. You know, throughout the British Commonwealth, governments are patterned on the British Parliament with a House of Commons and instead of a House of Lords, a Senate. Australia got rid of its Senate. Canada has never really known what to do except make it a post for sinecure patronage. It is meant to be that chamber of sober second thought that is part of the British parliamentary system. It has no overriding powers. The democratically elected House of Commons does, but the 100 members of the Senate have awfully nice offices and nice perks. The problem is that three conservative senators, two of them, I should say, former prominent journalists, were caught playing their expenses, and two of them claimed to live in Pamela Wallen, a very, very famous broadcaster, had from Saskatchewan, lives in Toronto, but kept claiming expenses to go back to Saskatchewan, claiming residency in Saskatchewan. And Mike Duffy, another very well-known broadcaster from Prince Edward Island, has lived in Ottawa all of his adult life, suddenly moved his residency to Prince Edward Island and was caught making claims for housing in Ottawa. These sums are not huge. I mean, this is Canada, after all. We're not talking hundreds of thousands. We're talking tens of thousands at most. But it just offends, as it should, everyone. And on top of that, the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, 7 years in office, loved by his followers, but loathed by many, has been his chief of staff resigned some time ago, having given Duffy $90,000 to cover his legal expenses. And so this is getting very close to Stephen Harper and threatens Stephen Harper's ability to get reelected.
And it is really fascinating to watch because, of course, when the Liberal Party was in power before, it was the Conservatives crying foul for the Senate, saying we need to reform the Senate. We need to change the way it's done. And now look at the Conservatives, 7 years in power, Stephen Harper at the top, nothing's changed. And I don't really hear calls from his office saying that we're going to reform the Senate.
Well, I think that this may well be the beginning of the end for it finally. And it's hard because to change these constitutions in all these countries requires a consensus. And Canada requires 7 of 10 provinces, half of its population. It's not that easy to get that through. And they've got other things on their agenda. But I think the revulsion is so strong now, there could well be momentum. Probably not until the government changes. Those old enough to remember Pierre Trudeau will know that, will be interested to know if they don't already, that his son Justin Trudeau is leader of the Liberal Party, which suffered a calamitous defeat in the last election, but is now rising quickly. And Justin is a very charismatic man, much like his father, very young, very, very appealing. And you know, all governments get stale. I mean, it's just the nature of, you know, that's why the U.S. has term limits. And it's the nature of these governments. And it's not clear that what will happen in the next election. It's not imminent. But certainly Harper has reason to be anxious. And I think, you know, if you look at, as I have online, Jon Stewart and The Daily Show in the U.S., David Letterman, Jay Leno, they are having a field day. You know, this is looking at Canada and all of its ethical lapses between its mayor and the senators are not really on the radar as much, I must say. But it is, you know, Canada is always slightly smug and righteous. And I say this as a expatriate Canadian about its wholesomeness. And this has not been a very
well, at least people are talking
week.
About us now.
Yeah, well,
yeah. let's execute a graceful arabesque, perhaps, and plié onto another topic.
Well, speaking of a country with dirty laundry, this is an incredibly interesting case. This is the artistic director of the Bolshoi Ballet in Moscow. You may remember Sergei Filin last January was coming home on a snowy winter day when a man with his face covered in a scarf threw acid in his eyes and has since gone through 23 operations to try to salvage his eyesight and restore his skin. then they discovered that one of the senior dancers at the ballet, a guy named Pavel Dmitrichenko, was allegedly behind this. He's been arrested, and he is on trial right now, along with two accomplices. And what a dramatic trial it is.
Sitting in a metal cage. And
well, they just... do this, you know, in Russia, you know, as you may remember, also in Egypt, too. We've seen that just this week.
Yeah, it just highlights all the backstabbing and the plotting that was happening at the Bolshoi.
Well, you know, I don't know if you've seen Black Swan, but, you know, we tend to sort of mythologize the kind of ambition and clawing that, you know, and it's often projected onto women in the ballet, that you know, this kind of nastiness. But here you have a group of men. And in fact, Dmitrichenko's motive appears to be that he felt that he wasn't being given senior enough roles, and his girlfriend, who had left the Bolshoi, was being underappreciated by Filin. And so he, in a burst of anger, is alleged to have hired a hitman to throw acid at the artistic director's face, and now faces 12 years in prison. And the case, he yesterday in the dock admitted, it was a very strange thing that he did. He admitted moral responsibility without admitting having actually done it.
Very interesting stuff. We'll definitely be keeping an eye on that very dramatic
trial. Soon to be
trial.
Made into a major motion picture, you can be sure.
Part two.
That was Jeffrey Kaufman from ABC News. Thank you very much indeed.
Coming up after this very short break, we'll be discussing how the Jordan Valley could be the key to any future Israeli-Palestinian peace deal.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Georgina Godwin. Now, John Kerry has been in the Middle East this week, desperately trying to save what is left of what seems to be a crumbling peace negotiation between Israel and the Palestinians. It seems that one of the biggest hurdles to any sort of lasting peace deal rests with what might happen in the Jordan Valley.
Israel announced that it wants to build a security barrier between Jordan and the West Bank, stretching from the Dead Sea to the southern Israeli town of Eilat. As can be expected, Palestinian opposition to any kind of barrier has been fierce. Well, to find out more about why the Jordan Valley could be key to any future deal, we're now joined on the line by Dalia Hutakwa, a journalist based in the West Bank. Welcome to the programme, Dalia.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the Israeli Prime Minister has accused the Palestinians of creating artificial crises to run away from historic decisions. He said this just last night. Is this the truth, do you think?
Well, I'm not quite sure if it's artificial. You've got some major hurdles that have come up, and there's nothing artificial about those. You have two separate but very linked issues that have happened in the past couple of days. And on the one hand, you have reports that the Israelis are going to be using the current barrier, which has already been built in the West Bank. This was built back in 2002. And they're going to be using that as for future border demarcations. Now, this is unheard of because if you recall back in 2002, the wall was built on the pretext that it would stop suicide bombers from entering into Israel. But back then, the Palestinians were saying that the main point of the wall is to actually grab more land. And now finally, you have these reports coming out that Israel is in fact going to be using this wall as a border. The other issue is that as soon as Kerry, Secretary of State Kerry, was about to come to the West Bank, you hear that the Israeli authorities plan to build a wall between the Jordan Valley and the West Bank and Jordan. Now, this is also major because the Jordan Valley has been a sticking point in negotiations for decades, and for good reason, because that area along with the Northern Dead Sea, it encompasses some 30% of the entire West Bank. It's a huge area, and it's also the breadbasket of the West Bank. And so it's flooded with supplements at the moment. And once you have this wall, effectively what Israel is doing is creating a status quo, and it will be very difficult to negotiate on anything in the future.
Dalia, the Israelis would argue that they need this land to really protect it, and it's for security, namely that they need this land to protect the city of Tel Aviv if there was to be any future incursion.
First of all, Tel Aviv is very far away from the Jordan Valley. And the main reason that the Israelis said that they would build this barrier in the West Bank, in the Jordan Valley, is actually, it has nothing to do with the Palestinians. They're talking about Syrians who have fled to Jordan. And they're saying that there are fears that these Syrians would somehow cross the border and get into the West Bank, and from the West Bank get into Israel. Number one, there's never been any reports of that ever happening. And number two, the likelihood of that happening is very slim. So again, the barriers that are being built, because it's not just in the West Bank and in the Jordan Valley, there are other barriers being built in the Golan Heights, by the Golan Heights on the Syrian border and by the Egyptian border. So if you look at all these together in a package, you can see that what Israel is doing is actually putting its foot down and essentially creating the borders that it wants.
Just staying with the Jordan Valley for a moment, a spokesman for Abbas has actually said that the Israeli premier's statements on building a wall in the Jordan Valley is only a proactive step to foil Secretary Kerry's visit at the moment. This has all only come up because of to foil the peace talks, essentially.
Correct. We had a statement a couple of days ago from the Palestinian Authority, but as usual, it's been timid and pro forma. The short statement was, you know, essentially saying that it was, like you mentioned, a preemptive step to thwart Kerry's visit. It was also coupled by a plea to Washington to kind of take a firm stand against this plan. But funnily enough, in Bethlehem, where Kerry met with the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, he didn't even mention it. Essentially, people or Palestinians are quite upset that the Palestinian Authority hasn't taken a much more harsher response to this Israeli plan, especially at a time when groups like Peace Now, which monitor the settlements, they say that settlement building is at its highest level in a decade.
Dalia, how much is this about money, though? A recent report by the World Bank suggested that the Palestinian economy could be boosted by some $1 billion if it had access to minerals in the southern parts of the Jordan Valley. Is this just a matter of the Israelis perhaps not wanting the Palestinians to be able to boost their economy?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, it's much bigger than that. It's about borders, and borders are the single most important thing in this issue.
But how important is the economy, the economic factors in this discussion?
The economic factor is very important. As I mentioned earlier, the Jordan Valley has the capability to be the breadbasket of the West Bank. And essentially what you have right now in the Jordan Valley is it's the richest area for water resources. And as you may well know, water is more important than oil or gas here. It's very essential, and especially in the Jordan Valley, where you see settlements, there's dozens of settlements, and they're thriving because they have access to water, because they have access to utilities and infrastructure provided by the Israelis, and they're able to export dates and other products. But on the other hand, you've got the Palestinian farmers who are lagging behind. They don't have access to water. They're constantly being their shacks and even wells constantly being demolished. They don't have access to water and other important infrastructure. And so they're not able to provide, and food prices are really, really high.
Dalia, we're going to have to leave it there, but many thanks for joining us on the program. Dalia Hatuka speaking to us from the West Bank. After this very short break, we'll be in Belgrade.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Learning from a master is a privilege in any sphere. To nurture ideas for the arts, Rolex's Mentor and Protégé initiative has been teaming leading practitioners with promising protégés around the globe. Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound hopped over to Venice to talk to some protégés and mentors.
Everybody's moved out of institutional thinking and behavior and moved into something that's way easier, more honest, more direct, and more collaborative. As an artist, it's not interesting to be a private genius. What you want is to be part of a movement.
You can watch Rob Bound's film on monocle.com.
It's 9:26 in Belgrade, 8:26 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Georgina Godwin, and Phil Hahn. It's time now to cross over to Serbia to get the latest news from the region. And joining us on the line is Monocle's Guy Delaunay. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Georgina.
Now, there have been elections in the northern part of Kosovo, and they were a bit of a shambles at the weekend. Yeah. Just remind us what happened there, Guy.
Yes, indeed. There was a complete shambles, really, in the northern part of Kosovo. Now, these were elections being held across the Republic of Kosovo, which self-declared its independence 5 years ago. And for the first time, the ethnic Serbs in the north who've refused to recognise this unilateral declaration of independence were being asked very strongly to vote, to take part as in a way of showing that relations between Serbia and Kosovo are normalising. Now, nobody was turning out to vote, basically, in the main town of North Mitrovica. And then with about 2 hours to go of the polls, a group of masked men ran in and started smashing up ballot boxes. The international observers who were there fled in rather dramatically in full body armour. And that was the end of the vote.
And Guy, I know that there have been calls for a rerun in North Mitrovica on the 17th of November, but if that indeed does go ahead, that doesn't necessarily solve the underlying root problem, which is that many Serbs in the north of Kosovo simply do not want to vote. They'll continue to boycott these elections if they go on. So how do they solve that main issue?
Yeah, it's a really big issue. I mean, look at it on the face of it. There's all sorts of problems going on here, but this is the root of it. These 50,000 or so ethnic Serbs who live in North Kosovo don't believe that the Republic of Kosovo should exist. They consider themselves to be citizens of Serbia, and they say that they will never belong to the Republic of Kosovo. So how can you ask them to vote in an election that's held under the auspices of that very same country? It's an impossible task, and it's a very interesting situation. You see, which happens a lot, I think, when the European Union gets involved with elections. The people of North Kosovo gave a fairly eloquent answer by not turning up at the polls. They don't recognise what's going on. They're not going to be bossed around by Belgrade, the government there, which has been urging them to vote, or the people in Brussels, or the people in Pristina. And yet they're essentially being asked, well, being told, wrong answer, try again. And I must also add that they will hotly deny that they were the people behind the smashing up of the ballot boxes. They say that only happened when it became clear that nobody had voted. So yes, really, 17th of November, why should they turn out then? What's changed?
And it's interesting, Guy, you mentioned the EU's involvement in all of this. Of course, the foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, has rested much of her political capital on this issue. Do we know, have we had any kind of reaction from her or from Brussels?
There's a meeting yesterday between Catherine Ashton and the prime ministers of both Republic of Kosovo and Republic of Serbia, at which they all presented a very nice face, said that the elections in the Republic of Kosovo had been very successful, bar this small incident in North Mitrovica, and that normalization agreement between Belgrade and Pristina would be moving on, would be implemented at an accelerated rate, which good luck on that if you can't get the North Kosovo Serbs to agree on things. But what was very interesting was Serbia's Prime Minister Dacic saying that 20,000 people in North Mitrovica can't be allowed to hold the future of 7 million in Serbia to hostage. So there's a very clear message there. You're too small for us to be worrying about. Move over and let us get on with the bigger picture.
Guy, let's move on to Bosnia, who've agreed an ID card solution.
Indeed they have. I mean, this was a very emotive issue. Earlier in the year, we had they stopped issuing IDs to newborn babies. And in June, there was one young baby girl who died, and her parents said if she'd had an ID, she would have been able to leave the country for medical treatment. And that sparked a very big protest. In Sarajevo, people formed a human chain around parliament and refused to let the lawmakers leave until they implemented a temporary law allowing IDs to be issued. And they finally sorted out this problem on a more permanent basis.
Well, some good news there for all newborn babies in Bosnia. Unfortunately, though, Guy, we've run out of time. But thanks for joining us here on the programme. Guy Delaney in Belgrade.
In the next half an hour of the programme, we'll find out why a 28-year-old Flemish Rwandan has been dominating the French charts for weeks, as Laurence Sellerus joins us on the line from Brussels to examine the appeal of the rapper Stromae. We'll also look at the British front pages, and we'll meet a man who's rethinking the way we use office space.
But first, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
Further talks on Iran's nuclear programme are getting underway today in Geneva. Over the next 2 days, representatives of major world powers and officials from Tehran will try to build on a meeting last month which was described as substantive. Pakistan's former military ruler Pervez Musharraf has been released from house arrest. He's still banned from leaving the country, though. The move comes days after he was bailed in the last legal case against him. Israel has said a report which suggested the late Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat was poisoned is more soap opera than science. The Swiss report came after the decision to exhume his remains last year. It's 9 years now since Yasser Arafat died, and the report says there is evidence that he was poisoned with the radioactive agent polonium. A powerful storm is heading for the Philippines. Typhoon Haiyan's due to reach land on Friday. A number of schools have been closed already and evacuations ordered in the regions most at risk from the storm. And one of the world's biggest oil companies is rejecting claims that it's failed to report the true extent of oil spills in Nigeria. The human rights group Amnesty says firms often blame sabotage to avoid paying compensation, but Shell says the allegation is unsubstantiated. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
It's 10:32 in Beirut and 8:32 in London. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin, and Phil Hahn. Last year, the British Prime Minister David Cameron announced a £50 million investment in a new building to sit atop Old Street Roundabout in East London. This area is the core of the neighbourhood that's organically grown into the preferred home to the city's tech startups. And the intention is to galvanise the industry even further.
Well, do coders need an auditorium, though, Georgina, to be creative? Well, in this week's edition of The Urbanist, Andrew Tuck asks what cities should be doing to cultivate communities for startups. And in this preview, Monocle's David Michon meets John Worthington, an architect and a director at the Academy of Urbanism. He's been pioneering changes in both office spaces and urban planning to support the growth of creative industry. He was a consultant for the founders of the popular co-working space Hub in London.
The Hub, which is now a global business, started about 8 years ago. I helped the two young people who set it up, actually. It's not a real estate deal. It is actually saying, let's go into a building, but it's more than the environment, and it's the relationship of all the people who come together. And so the Hubs, the Hub Westminster, for instance, which is in New Zealand House, is around microfinancing and social networking businesses. So it's absolutely right in opposite the Institute of Directors on what I call the cliff face of the establishment. Hub King's Cross is much more about welfare services. Hub Angel is about environmental green businesses. So it's about relationships and bringing similar sorts of people together who share information. So that's really two ways about the hub. Or, of course, as I said, you can get neighborhoods.
Now, in the hubs that are working places, you were kind of plotting this as kind of a more sophisticated example. What is the trajectory then for these types of working environments? How will we see them develop in cities as kind of this becomes a more important, more desirable part of the economy?
The ones I've talked about so far charge you a rent. And some of them very inventive, the way they're actually charging for what they're giving you. But others, of course, which are growing up, are the ground floor of a boutique hotel. Is it the Hoxton? Yes, in Shoreditch. It's a very successful hub, in a sense. People come there, there's touchdown space, you see them go. The Festival Hall. Go in there, look at where the columns are and where the plugs are, and there's people sitting on the floor plugged in. It's a kind of hub. To the extent upstairs, actually, they've got a club. And you can pay a very minimum amount, I think it's 50 quid a year, and you're a member of it, and you can actually go there and just have touchdown space and work. So I think what we're seeing is it going into, I can go almost anywhere and have a hub now.
I mean, that's really interesting because you see London conceiving of these projects, for instance, in Shoreditch at Old Street Roundabout, to build a new building to provide space for startups, but also established companies as a kind of way of kind of cross-pollinating ideas. But you're saying that, in fact, the future is that it's even less formal, or it will continue to be less formal. I just want to know from you what you think the relationship is between the infrastructure and the ability for a place to serve as a hub.
Most of the hubs we know about have grown organically. What started them was cheap and space with lots of capacity. Yeah, so you can get in and out quickly. These were old warehouses. That's what Shoreditch was. There was a problem with the planning, because it was seen to be needed for industrial. And of course, what these early things were actually industrial, were making things, but they looked like offices. So there was a real problem in those early days. But that's when we started in somewhere like that. As they mature, of course, you probably will now get into needing buildings. People like Derwent Valley, the developers, did things like the T building down off Brick Lane. And they're now doing an even bigger building. This will be the kind of things which will grow. But the difficulty is those rentals might go way up. And now you're looking really at the much more mature firms. But actually what an environment wants ultimately as a mature hub is what I call all the steps on the premises ladder, from the startups, dead cheap, to mature firms who actually are prepared to pay that rent. So,
but this is, it's not, you're not thinking about this in kind of, not like gentrification where you kind of end up in a place, but those things coexisting, you think that's valuable?
Yeah, they need to coexist. They often don't, unluckily, because as you know, the key old-fashioned way with property was, you said, this is a A-class top rental property, so everything's got to be that. What they, of course, killed was that sense of diversity that actually successful local economy has small startup firms as well as big firms. The small startup firms are able to support the big corporates and they work together.
So do you think it's a smart investment on the part of, a national government or a city government to contribute to building these kind of massive buildings? Or do you think, in fact, if, the IBMs of the world want to get something from the young innovative startups, they should be, it's on their backs to bring themselves to those places.
I think cities must get into this. Mm. It's absolutely essential. But what they have to realize that they no longer are controllers. They have to be facilitators. So up front, what they might need to do is not actually see the first thing is, I'm going to give them a great big new building. Won't it be wonderful? And we'll have a wonderful kind of environment of young creatives, because it'll be too expensive, it'll be the wrong kind of place, and they aren't able to feel they've made it themselves. So you need to be at the bottom rung of this premises ladder I've got of all these different types of firms, the ability to actually just nurture and facilitate and allow it to happen. So you're loose about planning, you're easy about kind of letting people come in and have sweat equity to do things in those buildings. And then as you mature up, and these all ultimately need to be in the same neighborhood, you will have top-level developers coming in and developing some buildings and that happening together.
And that was John Worthington there speaking to Monocle's David Michon for this week's Urbanist All About Hubs. Well, you can catch the full interview tonight at 1900 hours if you're in London, that's 6 a.m. in Melbourne, and 1300 hours if you happen to be in Chicago.
You're listening to Midori House. Next up, we'll be discussing a young man who's chronicling the existential crisis of a lost generation in Europe.
It's not me.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe. The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
Do you ever survey a parade of shops and gathered locals and wonder why the scene is so inviting? Well, to find out, Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, ventured to Wilton Way, a small thoroughfare in East London's Hackney, to get a read on the ingredients that underpin a community.
In a former post office at number 67, Borough Wines is a perfect example of modern renewal born out of village ideals. The success of Muriel Châtel's Hackney Wine Shop is down to the daily engagement with the locals. In addition to the expertly chosen bottles on the shelves, Borough Wines provides a fill-your-bottle-at-the-barrel service offering simply one red, one white, and one rosé at a comforting price.
You can watch Tyler Brulé's Hackney Revival film in the programmes menu on monocle.com.
It's 9:42 in Bruges, 8:42 in London. You're listening to Midori House. Well, could we have found the Morrissey of Middle Europe? In the way that the British singer represented the disaffected generation of the 1980s, Paul Van Haver is being hailed as the spokesperson for young Europeans suffering an existential crisis.
Wow. Well, in a recent New York Times interview with Van Haver, who's also known more commonly as Stromae, the paper said he had channeled to popular acclaim the grey that currently hangs over Europe. Well, he rose to prominence 4 years ago with a song that mixed rap with a heavy beat and gave a rather dark view of life in the Eurozone in Allons en danse.
Fatigue, dit réveil, encore sourd de la veille. Alors on sort pour oublier tous les problèmes. Alors on danse.
Georgina, put the hands down. Not the time and place. Well, that was, of course, Laurent Danse. Well, joining us now on the line from Brussels is Monocle contributor Laurent Seroulous. Welcome to the show, Laurent. What is it about Stromae that has people talking? He's, you know, summing up this existential crisis, so to speak, of a generation.
Well, thanks for having me. And I'd say that on an international level, his music relates very well to certain issues that Europe is having and Europe is experiencing at this moment. One of them would be youth unemployment. Another one would be an economic crisis. You see that the future is quite grim for young Europeans. And here comes this musician who makes dance music where people can dance to and sort of forget their troubles. And he seems to represent this well. He seems to have become sort of symbol of this generation.
Does he talk about it in his music? I mean, can you give us an example of his lyrics, the sort of thing that he sings about?
One of the things that he's praised for is the fact that his songs and his lyrics have substance. You mentioned the example of Alors on danse. Basically, what that song says this is what's happening. We're having economic difficulties. We're without jobs, but let's dance and let's have fun. But that's not the only example. He personally is from a mixed race background. He has a father that origins in Rwanda, and his mother is a Flemish lady. And he also plays with that theme. He discusses his mixed background and the fact that he never knew his father. So time and time again, you see that his songs have substance, and they talk about something, and that's why people relate very well to what he's speaking about.
But Lauren, do we think we're perhaps giving Stromae a bit too much credit, where perhaps, you know, he's just singing a few lyrics? I don't really see him advocating for much change in the halls of parliament across Europe. I don't see him out there on austerity protests demanding more jobs. Do you think we're giving him a bit too much credit?
Could be. I mean, that's what happens with musical musicians who become icons, I guess. Mostly it's out of their hands, and it's something that I guess media like to use in their headlines. But still, we have to recognize the importance. And I think he's a Belgian artist, and in Belgium he means just a bit more than that, because he's also very important for what we now are experiencing in Belgium, which is a crisis of confidence, a problem with national identity. And specifically on that issue, he's been quite important the past months and years in bringing forward a sort of national pride and a sort of Belgitude. But that relates mostly to the Belgian population.
And Lawrence, you're talking about cultural icons, and here in Britain we've seen a cultural icon or a youth leader, the comedian Russell Brand, talking or calling for youngsters or people in general, but mostly his constituents are the youth, to actually walk away from the democratic process. Now, is Stromae advocating anything similar? Is this a Europe-wide movement? And is he actually calling for any specific change?
No, he's not. He's. I think what he represents is a part of the population, which is a young part of the population, that has lost the track. But at the same time, he's not politically outspoken. In Belgium, he tends to stay away from the topic. In Europe, I haven't heard him make big political speeches or send out big manifestos to change modern day society. What is important is, I think, is the fact that he's a pop icon, and the fact that he represents this. He's a symbol. He's a symbol for a generation, I'd say.
Laurens Seleroos in Brussels, thank you very much for joining us today. And I think we should see if he's any good, Phil.
Well, let's hear a song by Stromae now. Here is Papa Ute.
Dites-moi d'où il vient, enfin je saurai où je vais. Maman dit que lorsqu'on cherche bien, on finit.
That was Stromae there with Papa Ute. Great track. Are you a fan?
I'm not convinced, you know. I mean, I'm all for him, you know, representing disaffected youth.
He's defining a generation.
Is he?
Yes.
Well, it's a generation I'm quite glad to no longer be a part of.
Ouch.
It's 11:51.
Showing your age, Gigi. Showing your age.
It's 11:51 in Amman, 9:51 in Milan, and 8:51 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Georgina Godwin, and Phil Hahn. And it's time now to have a look at this morning's British newspapers. So joining us in the studio is Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning to you, Georgina. And Phil, good morning to you as well.
Pleasure as always to see you here, bright and early.
Absolutely.
Now, we've all got our sunglasses on, we're turning up our collars, and we're being very, very furtive, because it's all about spying this morning.
That's right. Interesting piece in the Financial Times this morning about intelligence agency chiefs stepping from the shadows. This is a committee of MPs who are going to question, grill, if you like, Georgina, the heads of MI5, MI6 and GCHQ. Obviously, now, some of these people make a bit better at dealing with the media, a bit more media savvy, media friendly even. our listeners may remember that Andrew Parker, who's the Director General of MI5, made a pretty sort of prominent speech fairly recently, where he's very, very critical in particular of The Guardian for publishing various Edward Snowden related documents. He courted quite a lot of controversy for that, but he looked fairly comfortable in the spotlight.
And John Sawyers has always been very open about his position, hasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, absolutely. And he's probably the most comfortable of all of them in terms of dealing with high-profile public appearances. He's a good mover and shaker amongst the sort of Westminster community. And although he's had some problems of his own, there's been questions particular about some of the work of MI6, in particular in Iraq and Libya, which he's had to deal with. He's generally impressed and he's got a very good reputation. In particular, he's sort of our best expert on Iraqi policy, for example. I think the most interesting appearance will be by Sir Ian Lobban, who's the director of GCHQ. And now we see people will remember that GCHQ was sort of complicit, supposedly, in a lot of this NSA work. It was it's the government listening post just outside Cheltenham here in the UK. So he probably has the most to answer. And he has always been, historically, the most discreet. So he hasn't really got any sort of meaningful public profile. People don't really know what he's like as a character. So I think it'd be very interesting to see how he stands up to the scrutiny.
And do you think we're actually going to hear anything surprising, or will it be kind of the more muted answers that we might expect?
I think that's an interesting point, Phil, because obviously I imagine that Sir Ian Lobban in particular will be fairly muted. It's unlikely that he's going to make any outstanding revelations. However, you know, these committees they've got a lot more sort of aggressive in the last few years. It used to be a bit more of a kind of mealy mouth thing. They're very aggressive. They're very direct. They know that they can get a lot of traction out of people. And I don't think that if he just tries to be rather evasive, if he's a bit standoffish, that'll wash. I think they're going to expect him to explain himself, and they'll definitely want to know exactly what the relationship between the shadier elements of the NSA and the US sort of snooping operations and GCHQ have been, particularly with regard to what GCHQ is doing in terms of listening, not just to the members of the British public, but to the European community more widely.
Mm-hmm. You know, from the other side, I appeared in front of one of those committees once, and it's as you're saying, it's very aggressive. It's actually quite scary sitting there with a room full of generally men, and it's all just this kind of question. There's no
letter. You're not a spy, though, are you?
It wasn't about spying.
Okay. what was it about, Georgia, if I can pry?
It was about the political situation in Zimbabwe the time a few years ago, but it's a very intense experience, and I imagine that those men will be really on the edges of their seats.
Absolutely, and I think it'll be good theatre. So it'll just be very interesting to see how they stand up to the scrutiny. As you said, I think John Sawyers will probably be fine. Andrew Parker also, all eyes and ears, appropriately, will be looking and listening to see what Ian Lobban has to say.
Well, that's 21st century espionage, but you've got a bit of a historical example of spying.
Yeah, there's kind of... Well, in fact, it wasn't spying, Phil. That was what was interesting about it. It was alleged spying.
Okay.
So this was Charles Rennie Mackintosh, this celebrated Glaswegian sort of polymath artist, designer. People will be familiar with his, you know, architectural influences, design influence. But apparently, when he was residing in Walberswick, the charming Suffolk village. Have you visited, Phil?
Never been. Sounds nice, though.
I have. It's very pleasant.
Okay. We should go someday.
Well, it's a sort of bizarre wartime story.
Sorry, is this a date being planned here?
Well, I was suggesting that Phil went. I didn't want to go together, but there we are. But First World War. So in 1914, he had a home in Walberswick, which faced the sea. And because he was quite a hands-on guy, design character, he was trying to fix a lamp in his living room that was faulty. And as he tried, it sort of would flicker on and off. And then who would turn up, of course, but the Secret Services, who had reports that some nefarious person on the coast was trying to signal to enemy warships at sea. So they turned up to his house, and he obviously, Mackintosh wasn't best pleased. But the story gets better, because he had just received a whole batch of correspondence from Hermann Mathusius, Joseph Ulbricht and Joseph Hoffmann, who were leading figures in the German arts and crafts movement. So obviously all these letters were in German. So they were like, well, how do you explain these? And then, charmingly, he then responded angrily to them, and they mistook his Glaswegian accent. They believed him to be German. So it all got very unsavoury. He had a night in the cells in Southwold, appeared before magistrates, was kept under surveillance, but before finally
he's been cleared,
getting help from friends in Whitehall. And so people are trying now to sort of formally clear his name all these years later.
And that's why he's back in the news, is it, with this attempt to clear him?
Absolutely. So I believe there's an apology from the Suffolk Coast, a tourism body. I wonder what their motivation could be for this, Georgina. Hard to imagine, isn't it?
We have just under a minute. Let's get our two more stories in very quickly. We've got some good ones.
Yeah, this is a fun story in The Guardian. No sexism, please. We're Swedish. Apparently, Swedish cinema now classifies films not just for suitability of content, but by their representation of women. So that in order to try and push for gender equality, they've got this fairly blunt tool. Charlotte Higgins, the chief arts writer, describes it. Basically, the movie must contain at least two named female characters who must then talk to each other about something other than men. That's how it escapes being sexist. And basically, virtually every film you can think of falls foul of this, including some established classics. There are some that pass with flying colours, sort of feminist iconography, you know, great celebrations like Alien with, you know, Sigourney Weaver as this sort of crusading female character. But many people fall foul. Whole series of films stumble under this. So, you know, the Star Wars movies, all the Harry Potter films, Pulp Fiction, unsurprisingly, all fall foul. So watch out, Hollywood. Swedish women
and
are coming
very quickly, it's
you.
Not a paper review without any animal talk.
Well, yeah, very, very briefly, I wanted to mention this dinosaur. So we think Tyrannosaurus is the most fierce of all. That's not right, Phil. It's King of Gore, Lythranax Argestes from Utah. 2.5 tons, a head full of sharp teeth. Sounds like someone I know.
Well, fortunately, though, that is all the time we have. Thanks very much, Tom, and also thanks to our producer, Barbara Feeney, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Andrea Alacon, and our studio manager, Chris Chilvers. Up next, after the news, is Culture with Robert Bound. The briefing is here at midday London time. I'll be back with Marcus Hippie for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Georgina Godwin. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. 1 year can inspire a lifetime.